It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's Friday. And we're starting a new Friday tradition right here on Talk is Jericho. After the ridiculous knock-knock jokes, after the bad limericks and quips, the new Friday tradition is the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Okay, so the woman comes in panicked into the bed. She's got her parrot, and the parrot's just limp. And the vet sees her and says to her, okay, bring her into the examining room, the parrot. And the woman brings her parrot in there, and the vet comes in, and he's like, looks at the parrot, and says, I'm sorry, ma'am, your parrot's dead. And she's like, wait, that was really fast, you know, like, you didn't run any tests, you gotta run some tests, I mean, how do you know? And the vet's like, really, you want some tests? I mean, I can do that. Yeah, run some tests. And the vet opens the door to the examining room, and this black Labrador comes in, and he's like, doo-doo, and jumps up on the table and sniffs the parrot, and the parrot's all limp, and the lab looks at the vet with sad eyes and kind of nods his head and jumps off and leaves the room. And the vet says, yeah, for sure, your parrot's dead. I mean, and the woman's like, what the f*** was that? You know, I mean, it's a dog. Like, well, you need to run some tests. And he's like, okay, you want another test? And he opens the door again to the room, the dining room, and this little kitty comes in, meow, 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 jumps up on the table, meow, meow, sniffs the parrot, meow, meow, looks at the vet, jumps off and leaves the room. And he says to the vet, says, you know, for sure, your parrot's dead, that's it. And she goes, well, I mean, I don't even get what that was all about. And, well, I guess you're right. The parrot's dead. Oh, she's so sad. And the vet hands her a bill for $750. She's like, wait, what the hell was this? And the vet says, well, you know, if you would have just taken my word for it that he was dead, it would have been $50. But with the labs and the CAT scan. Thank you very much.
What a start. There you go. There's your start right there. Duff McKagan, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer from Guns N' Roses, is also a bad joke aficionado. So there you go. Get used to that every week. If Duff can't call it in, I will read his personally chosen joke every Friday only here on Talk is Jericho. If that's not good enough, then maybe this will. Today's pod, we're talking about zonkies. That's right. I said zonkies. I know you're thinking, what? But I'm talking about zonkies. That's what I thought when my guest Rainn Wilson said he had one, and that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt wanted to come to his house to meet it. That's just one of the great, crazy, true stories you'll hear from Rainn Wilson coming up. That's right, Dwight Schrute from The Office here on Talk is Jericho. Or maybe you know him better as Fishboy from House of a Thousand Corpses, my favorite role he's ever played. And soon you'll know him from his role on the upcoming Star Trek Destroyer series. We're talking about all of that and what brought him out to West Hollywood in the first place. He spent 10 years on the New York theater scene before moving across the States, and he definitely didn't make it the moment he got to Los Angeles. You hear all about that as well. I've got Rainn Wilson coming up talking all about the trials and tribulations of his career. We're talking about the Rocker as well. Big news this week, though, before we get to Rain. Finally, it's been a long time coming, but we're here at last after the survey you did last year. Trials and tribulations, even losing our boat. Don't even get me started on that. We are unveiling this week the debut voyage of the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, October of 2018, going from Miami to Nassau. And check out this lineup. It is insane. I'm going to tell you right right now. I'm going to read it to you. Chris Jericho. Yeah, that's me. Hosted by Jim Ross, Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat will be there. Rey Mysterio, Lance Storm and Cyrus doing Killing the Town. Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms doing Keeping It 100. Beyond the Darkness will be there, spinning scary stories. Busted Open Radio will be there. Raven will be there doing some comedy. Jim Brewer will be doing comedy. And we got some great rock and roll bands as well. Fozzy, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons. That's right, Phil Campbell from Motorhead, carrying on right where Motorhead left off after Lemmy passed away. Then we got King, Fozzy, The Dives, Jim Brewer's Loud and Rowdy, Dave Spivak Project. You heard Spiwi's songs here many times. We got Shoot to Thrill, the world's best female AC/DC cover band, Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy Osbourne cover band. And the best thing is, there's more to be added, but the pièce de résistance is Ring of Honor presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches will be happening as the cruise is going in the middle of the ocean. Pro wrestling at its finest with Ring of Honor. The winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship title shot at some point. So lots at stake here. Very, very cool. If you want to be a part of this, and people are already snapping up the cabins as it is, you can get a cabin starting at $150. Just go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com. That's ChrisJerichoCruise.com. I wanted to make this as fun of an experience as it could possibly be, and we're doing it. Starting October of 2018, plenty of time to save up, and also not as much time to save up to come see Fozzy, which starts next week, September 26th. We're with Gemini Syndrome and The Stir, and we're starting off in Clarksville, Tennessee at The Warehouse, September 27th, Fort Wayne, September 28th, Columbus, Ohio. This show is about to sell out, so please get your tickets now for the A&R Bar. September 29th, Detroit at the Riff Fest, WRIF. September 30th, Libertyville, Illinois at Austin Fuel Room. That's just outside of Chicago. October 1st, Janesville, Wisconsin for Sonic Boom, another great festival. October 3rd, we're up in Niagara Falls at the Rapids Theater. October 4th, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania at the Chandelier. October 5th, Worcester, Massachusetts at the Palladium. October 6th, Wilmington, Delaware at World Live. October 7th, well, the Wilmington, North Carolina gig at the Muse got canceled because the Muse closed, but we are going over to the Tavern in Jacksonville, North Carolina, just down the road. You can get refunds at point of purchase for the Wilmington show, but come join us in Jacksonville, North Carolina. It's going to be even better. It's going to be even more fun because Wilmington closed down. So come on down the road and come join us in Jacksonville, North Carolina. Sorry, it wasn't at the Tavern. It's at the Tar Heel Opry House. The Tar Heel Opry House, October 7th in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And then finishing it all off October 8th in Winston-Salem at Johnny and June's Saloon. Then we'll be heading over to Europe. European tour starts October 27th in Birmingham, Dublin, Belfast, Chester, Manchester, London, Sheffield, Glasgow, Newcastle. Then we head over the pond to Europe, Amsterdam, Aschaffenburg, Pratteln, Roncade, Rome, Vienna, Munich, Essen, Hamburg, Genk. We're doing VIP meet and greets and pre-show mini concerts at all of those dates. It's one of the best VIP experiences you could ever have with Fozzy. Go get your tickets at FozzyRock.com. We're already putting together some good ones. Mental Health. We're probably going to do Crazy Train. We'll do a couple Fozzy songs that we're not going to do later on that night. It's going to be a fun time. FozzyRock.com. And the Judas record comes out October 13th. Judas still higher than it's ever been on the charts, but guess what? The second song is now out. This one is called Drinking with Jesus. The second song from Judas coming out. Here it is, coming at you live right here on Talk with Jericho.
Drowned in the holy water at the bottom of the trenches. Spirits and empty bottles as they wipe away my senses. Taking me low.
Hear my pain. No one borders. My friend, my love. All alone. and I'm drinking with Jesus.
Talk is Jericho.
I have no clue, by the way, what we're talking about.
So either
I'm just here.
Either
here
do I, my friend.
Have a conversation.
welcome to my world.
Because yeah. I don't. Yeah,
we have.
I don't really know what the show is, so we'll find out.
Here's what we're gonna do.
So, I love it.
We're here with Rainn Wilson at your house, and I love this LA vibe where you're in the city. It's super crazy, and then you go out like only 20 minutes, and like we're out kind of in the hills.
Yeah.
And there's a fence, and then there's this beautiful house behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which
little,
I love.
Little oasis.
Yeah.
Away from LA, but
yeah.
Close enough to LA,
mm-hmm.
So that I can sit in all of that horrible GD traffic.
But you're here too, and like you have this beautiful backyard out here. Ever have any animals out here at all?
This yard has been chock-a-block with animals. It's been a real menagerie over the years.
Great word, menagerie.
Yeah, and chock-a-block too. Got both of those in one sentence.
That's really
my
good.
Wife is totally
bonus
into
points.
Animals,
mm-hmm.
And she had we had horses here for a long time, and that just wasn't really practical. They mm-hmm. poop so much, Chris. Do you
horses.
Have any idea how much
I had no idea
poop?
How much they poop. No, I did not know
it's,
that.
It's crazy amount of poop, which means a lot of work. So we got rid of the horses.
Do you have to have a really big pooper scooper with that?
Yeah, but then we have, because we have this big hill,
yeah.
We have a little tractor. We drive the tractor filled with horse poop up and down, like every day.
The poop tractor?
Yeah, poop tractor.
So it's not practical.
Here it
horses.
Comes.
There you go.
So, Then we got a zonkey.
Now, hold on. What's a zonkey?
Do the math. Come on, Jericho. You can do it.
A zebra?
And an onkey, which is...
a donkey!
Yay!
Ah, more bonus points. Yeah, boy.
I've
honestly never heard of a zonkey before.
Yeah. They have them in Tijuana, but they're kind of fake. They mm-hmm. kind of paint donkeys with stripes and say, hey, here's a zebra or a zonkey
right.
or something like that. But they actually exist. My wife saw one. It's a craziest story. She Googled zonkeys,
mm-hmm.
and the first thing that came up is a website, zebrasareus.com. Not kidding.
Okay, right.
In Riverside, California.
Does it even have an R? Like zebras
yeah, yeah,
are
exactly.
Us?
Like toys
like
are
toys
us.
Are us.
Yeah,
okay.
Like a giant backwards R.
Right. Yeah.
And then she calls Zebras Are Us. And she's like, you guys have zonkeys? And they were like, yes. And as a matter of fact, there was a little zonkey baby boy. He was born just the other day. He's adorable. Want to see some pictures? My wife's like, yeah. And then they're like, $4,000. And in
Ooh.
6 months, we'll deliver him out to your house.
Why 6 months?
Because he's got to wean off his
oh, okay, gotcha,
zonkey
gotcha,
mom.
Gotcha.
His donkey mom.
His monkey.
And he has a donkey mom and a thing filled with zebra spermatozoa.
And that's how you make it?
Yep, that's how you make
just
it.
Just put it in there, the base.
Yeah, just like that.
So what kind of a tendencies does a zonkey have? What does it do?
He's a son of a bitch.
Oh, yeah. Bad guy?
He's they're no fun at
mm-hmm.
all. They're wild. They have the worst characteristics of both animals. So they're dumber than a donkey
mm-hmm.
and meaner and wilder than a donkey. And not as beautiful as a zebra.
It's a zebra.
So uglier than a zebra. Dumber and meaner than a donkey.
So that's
they're
right.
the worst.
Worst
they're
pet
worst.
You could have?
Yeah.
So the zonkey's not here anymore?
In fact, I heard a rumor because Zebras R Us called us later and said that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt wanted to buy zonkeys and have them shipped to their chateau in France. I'm not kidding you. And they wanted to come over and meet our zonkey.
Uh-huh.
But we were like out of town. And
sorry, Brad. I can't
yeah,
have
and
you.
And then the whole thing, then just a few months later, the whole thing blew up.
But how Hollywood is that though, right? Brad Pitt wants to get a zonkey and ship it to his chateau in France.
So he wants to meet the TV actor who's got one to like, to go out on that ice.
If a TV actor has like. One, I need to have seven.
I mean, in France. France.
Yeah, exactly, in France. Yeah. So the zonkey's gone now? The horses are gone?
The horses and the zonkey, and then we have a donkey named Chili Beans. They all live at a horse ranch outside of town.
Okay.
Further out. So, but now we got, then she fell in love with Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs. So we got two little pot-bellied pigs that live back there.
I used to live on a farm in Calgary, outside of Calgary, and the lady had a pot-bellied pig, and that was one of the most annoying creatures.
Really?
Because when you pick it up, which maybe you're not supposed
to. Well, that's, there you go, right? Because when you pick it up.
You're like in her early 20s, pick up the pig, and
oh, yeah.
So that, you do not pick up the pot-bellied
pig.
That's
squealers, yeah.
It's very
I got into it with the bigger pig named Snortington.
Of course.
He started getting territorial towards me in my own living room, Chris. He started trying to alpha me.
That son of a bitch.
As a wrestler, you know what that's like.
Sure.
You know, that's your cage. That's your octagon.
But it's still a wild animal, though.
Do you
let him...
No, I came at him. Okay. I was like, come at me, bro.
Did he pee on you?
He did go, I chased him around the table and I literally did like a caveman thing. I was like, oh, this is my living room. Then now he's terrified of me.
So you proved you're the alpha.
The balance is right. The force is right in the force.
Yeah, exactly. But I think I love coming to your place here and I'm looking around with like some of the art on the wall. I see a great picture over here with two penises tied together and like, is that a Slipknot?
Yeah, that's some kind of sailor's knot.
It's very well done. It's a little bit uncomfortable to envision.
Yeah, my buddy I went to high school with, he is actually my chemistry lab partner. His name is Joe Sola. He's an artist. His stuff shows in museums and stuff. And
so Joe did that. You did.
Joe painted the penises. But what's really funny is my son Walter, who's now 12. I think when he was like 9, he had a little friend over, and they were running around, and they came in there, and then I got a call from the friend's parents. They're like, do you have a picture of men's penises on your wall? Because our son was very disturbed. I was like, yes, but don't worry, it's art.
Yeah, it's art. That's the explanation, right?
It's modern art.
I had my second book, we were over in Iraq, and I took a picture on one of the military buses. And it was a penis with, like, we called him Mr. Cock and Balls, because it was a penis with a face and balls. Somebody had drawn it, like a soldier had drawn it. So I took a picture of it, and I put it in my book, like Mr. Cock and Balls, something that we experienced in Iraq. And I had a signing, and a lady came and said, my son took this book to school and showed this picture to his teacher. And he got in big trouble. I'm like, this is military. You can't give me crap for it. This is the U.S. military. They're standing up for, you know, certain times.
You're just documenting what you
see. Yes, I just documented what I'm seeing. Yeah. But that's it's funny, too, because it's fun for me to be here talking, because the first time I ever saw you was in A House of 1,000 Corpses.
Nice.
Which was just a completely insane movie.
You need a House of 1,000 Corpses tattoo.
I can't do that.
You've got some horror theme.
Well, they're all musical ones, right?
Okay.
But you got turned into a half man, half fish.
Yeah, fish boy.
Which is still fish boy.
Behold, fish boy.
But it was you and Hardwick, right?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Hardwick, yeah.
So, because you were you just starting out at that point in time?
Just totally starting out, yeah. I had done theater for 10 years in New York City, moved to L.A. I got a couple of good movie roles right off the bat and a few little TV things. But then it was just unemployed for like a year sitting around. And then I got the call, like, go in for this Rob Zombie horror film. And I don't even know how I got the audition. I guess my agent just, like, submitted me and they liked the look. And I came in and just one audition, met Rob, got the part. It was an awesome job. I mean, it's a classic horror film.
Did it say in the script he turns into fish boy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what were you thinking when you saw that? Like, am I actually going to be a fish? Or?
I thought, awesome! I get clubbed by giant scarecrow creatures, sawed in half, and my torso attached to a fish's tail, where I'm revealed to my screaming girlfriend as the villain is painting my naked fish torso.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, come on.
But like you said, it's become a cult classic at this point.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to hit in this business, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure when you were making that, it's just another gig at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And it almost, there was a big story behind that, because that film almost didn't get released. It was right during the time when Joe Lieberman in Congress was really cracking down on Hollywood and just like ratings and inappropriate material. We were made by Universal and Universal dumped us. And so we just, the film sat there for a year just on a shelf. And Lionsgate was just starting up, and that was one of Lionsgate's first purchases, one of their first releases, and they made a ton of money off of it.
Right.
It was a big success. So it kind of hit.
So when you talk about you were a theater actor for 10 years, and then you finally make the jump to LA, what were the big differences for you at first between theater and then obviously filming a movie or filming TV?
Yeah. So it's, you know, as an actor, first of all, in theater, you have to project to the audience. So if I'm angry at you and there's 800 people watching, I've got to be angry enough so that the guy in the last row can really get what I'm saying, right? So when you've got a camera, it's going to pick up everything that's going on in your eyes. And so it's a big shift externally to internally kind of work. It took me a while. I was definitely very nervous the first couple of jobs. In fact, that's one reason I'm really thankful for House of a Thousand Corpses, because it was about halfway through that movie where I got it. I was like, oh, I just relax and have a conversation.
The nuances of it,
and just let the camera capture what I'm doing. So, but I found it refreshing because I found New York theater, like, I love theater. I love making theater. I love to go back and do some more theater. It's when you see a great stage play, there's nothing better. And conversely, when you see a terrible stage play, there's nothing worse.
Yeah.
It's excruciating torture for 2 hours, and you can't escape. You probably have a friend in the play, and then you have to go up afterwards and be like, hey, buddy, that was something.
Here's what's like, how'd you like it? What'd you think when you're asking the guy?
You really shined.
And yeah.
You gave it your all.
You were there.
Hey.
You were there on
that stage. I saw you up there.
Oh.
Man.
But it's the same in wrestling, too. Like you said, like projecting to the guy in the last row.
Right.
And another thing that I always like, the difference is the instant gratification from the live audience.
Right.
You tell a joke, they laugh.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you.
And theater is an actor's art in that, you know, you're running the show ultimately. And, you're telling the story, and it's all in one take. You know what I mean? You know, you're not breaking it up into like all these little takes of five or six lines each. I found it kind of refreshing at first when I was in LA, because it's just a business. You know, it's a business. They want eyeballs. So if you're a bigger name and you get more eyeballs, then they treat you that way. And if you know what I mean? Then there's a lot of kind of BS in New York theater that's,
like the politics, you mean?
Politics of it and stuff like that. And there is in L.A. too, but ultimately L.A., it's, you know what it is. It is just a business. It's an entertainment business.
But so, in New York, what is it under the umbrella?
Well, it's under the guise of art.
Okay.
It's still a business, but they're pretending like they're making art, but they're really kind of doing business. So it feels, wait, I thought we were artists, but you're doing all this kind of business double dealing stuff. You know what I mean?
Right. Did you ever forget a line on stage where you get that horrible blank moment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's happened.
What do you
do? You just sit there and you just hope that it comes. Yeah. In fact, I did this one person monologue just last year here at a theater in LA. So it was just me talking for 70 minutes, kind of a performance monologue thing. And I was terrified of going up. And I kept a script off stage. And fortunately, it was a kind of a thing where I was just talking to the audience and telling the story this whole time. And one time I went completely blank. And I was there in front of an audience, and there was like, you know, 130 people watching me. And I was just like, and I just said, excuse me. And I walked off stage and I opened the script and I was like, okay. Oh, right. And I came back out and I was like, thank you. And then I just started up again. It was awesome.
See,
no one noticed. They thought it was part of the thing.
And that's the thing. If you don't let it on, no one knows what it's supposed to be.
They don't know.
They did this great part. We just walked off stage and walked back on stage. That's the way. It's same thing. Like when you are wrestling as well, you have these long monologues, interviews, promos, and it's one take. It's live. And if you forget, especially if you're a bad guy, it's easy because you just go like, I'm so mad right now. I can't even remember what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
You can always kind of phase it over.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't crack, people will never know.
Right.
You know?
Right.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become? Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass. Talk is Jericho.
So you're talking about you come to LA and you do Thousand Corpses. Was that did that kind of indirectly lead to getting the chance to be in The Office? Because that's the next thing that I saw you in was The Office.
Was The Office after that. Yeah.
Which one?
You know, I spent 4 or 5 years in LA just kind of like doing crappy little roles and just trying to make my rent, you know. And that was some good times, you know. I did a thing on like Charmed. Remember that show?
Yeah, yeah.
I was an evil demon, and then I did like CSI, and I was like a purse robber in a grocery store, and just a bunch of stuff like that. And how did it go? You know, it was a cool story. What led to The Office was I was on the show called 6 Feet Under that was on HBO, and. It was cool because I kept auditioning for these rinky-dink little parts. I mean, 3 lines here, 6 lines there, and I kept not getting cast. And one day I went in for literally like gay chorus member number 3 or something like that. And then I looked on the thing and they had this new role they were introducing. And they're like, this guy's going to be in 10 episodes and it's a major arc and he's an odd character and he's offbeat and... in kind of quirky and comedy and I just went to, I knew the casting director. So I was like, hey, any way I could audition for that? And she's like, let me check with the director. And she went and like, that's literally how she talked. And she's like, she went over to the director and he was like, can Ryan audition for Arthur? And they're like, sure. And so I literally spent like 45 minutes going over the script and I went in, I just nailed it. And so all of a sudden I was doing 10 episodes of a really hot show on HBO right when The Sopranos was on.
Yeah, I remember
The Wire
that show.
And the Wasn't, Entourage.
Michael C. Hall was on that too. Dexter, yeah.
Before Dexter, yeah.
Right.
And that's really what put me on the map. So it was, but if I had gotten, I always say this to like young actors, if I had gotten cast as gay chorus member number 3 or cater waiter number 2 or dead body number 4 or whatever it was, earlier, I never would have had that shot. Mm. So sometimes it's the failures that lead to our greatest successes, you know? And that was something else that happened in New York in the theater was I got cast in a Broadway show and I had a lead part in this Broadway show. And I felt so much pressure to like be good. And I thought in my head, I was like, oh, I'm going to get nominated for a Tony or I'm going to be in the New York Times. I'm going to sign at the William Morris Agency. Ooh, like I could be a star from this. I felt all that pressure that I sucked and I was terrible in the role. Mm-hmm. And I went through hell because there's nothing worse than doing a play and knowing that you suck while you're doing the play.
Right.
So, but at the end of it, like I fired my agents that were terrible and I kind of vowed to myself, like, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to, like, let the pressure of something, bring me down and limit who I am. I've got to be me. I've got to reflect who I am, bring myself to the role. And it was like this revelation kind of breakthrough. But I had gone through hell to get there. I was sobbing on the phone to my wife in the middle of the night and trying to work on the role and trying to salvage a performance. And I was just stiff and awkward, like a weird android. And if I hadn't gone through that, I never would have succeeded at playing Dwight. Because Dwight, I was able to bring a lot of myself, my quirkiness, my sense of humor, my oddness to the role and just not give a fuck, basically. And so if I hadn't gone through that horrible experience on Broadway, I never would have had success at Dwight. In the same way that if I hadn't missed out on all of those little parts, I never would have gotten Arthur on 6 Feet Under. So it's, you never know, those failures in your life can really lead to your greatest successes.
Mm. That's interesting. Because that happens too. Like, I've had a couple times where, like, not even audition, screen test for a part, actually for America's Funniest Videos. I actually did a couple episodes as the host before the audience. I was convinced, I got it. And then you get the call or you don't get it. Mm. It's crushing. Mm. When you're so like, I'm going to get this and you don't get it, it's hard to move along from that.
Yeah.
But you have to.
Yeah.
You know, did you ever almost have like a part like that where it just went through the...
I had this summer. I was up for like 2 or 3 movie roles, like doing deals, like getting ready to do like big, good roles. And they all fell apart. I didn't get fired, but the films fell apart.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
So and then I'm like, I'm unemployed.
But that's the hard thing about acting is like you're only as busy as your last part. And like, you could go years before you get another really big part, right?
Yeah, you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know when you're going to do some rinky-dink little horror movie and it becomes a cult classic.
Yeah.
And you never know when you do some big movie. I've done big, giant movies that tanked and no one saw them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That was part of my journey. It's just been an interesting journey. You know, I wrote a book, The Bassoon King, last year that came out that describes a lot of this because it's fascinating to me. Like, everything led up to, like, I did The Office and Dwight was so popular and then they greenlit this movie with me, The Rocker.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Where you were the lead.
Where I was the lead and in this great comic role, driving a 2-hour movie with an amazing cast. Mm-hmm. It had Emma Stone and Bradley Cooper in it and Josh Gad. Incredible cast.
Great story.
And a great story. And it tanked. Mm-hmm. It was one of the biggest box office bombs in American cinema history.
History.
I'm not kidding you.
Wow.
I'm not, like, opening weekend was like $2.8 million or something like that. It was just, and it was on 2,500 screens. So it's like, it just bombed and it was devastating. It was devastating to me.
Oh. How do you deal with that? Because, like, I did a movie called MacGruber. It was
Will
Forte.
Yeah.
Same thing.
I
like,
love that film.
We thought, like, you know, I wasn't in it a lot, but still, it was my first big screen. I went and saw it at the theater. You know how that feeling is.
Sure.
And the first week was, like, 3 million, and it's done. It's dead.
Yeah.
And you're like, how could this movie's so funny. How could it die like that?
But that one lives on. I think The Rocker lives on.
It does,
as well.
In retrospect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you deal with that? Like, were you getting the call? Like, okay, what are we at? What's the box office at tonight? Or do you follow? Or did you just kind of let it go and not worry about it?
Oh, it was devastating that, you know, I did a big press tour. It was my face on the poster and it just, people did not want to see it.
Wow.
And just that realization, like, people want to see you as Dwight. They're not interested in seeing you as something else.
I'm not a leading man.
You have not made that transition.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what it did for me is, like, I did a bunch of movies after that, one called Super that James Gunn directed and some other films, and I helped produce some films, and I just realized, like, you know what? Okay, Hollywood's not going to really embrace me in that way, but I'm going to just do my own projects. I'm going to write stuff. I'm going to produce stuff. I'm going to, you know, help create a media company. I'm going to just, if it's not coming to me in the way that I want, if it's not succeeding the way I want, then I need to be proactive and just do it myself.
And you have enough of a name where you can open some doors with stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. Rainn Wilson wants to come over and do this or whatever it may be. Let's talk a little bit about Dwight, because I was a huge fan of The Office, the original Office, the English Office.
Okay.
And one of my favorite characters, obviously.
You're not going to pull like a TV snob thing.
No, not at all.
I loved The English Office.
The worst show ever. Gareth was the character that Dwight is based on. And when the original American Office started, I was a little bit like, what are they going to do? Is it going to be exact replicas of the English, or what is it going to be? How was it pitched to you, and were you familiar with The English Office?
I loved The English Office, and I had this friend who's an actor and writer, and he's like, you've got to see this show. And he had gotten like some illicit copy of it when it was showing on the BBC. So I was one of the first people in America to literally see the thing.
Because it's funny, that was just before like YouTube and all that stuff was prevalent. So you actually had to get the DVDs from the BBC,
right,
from England.
And then you had to convert them to like American DVDs. Like,
that was only 2003.
Yeah.
It might as well have been in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Technology changes so fast. But I loved the show. I mean, I had never seen comedy, like that searing and awkward and weird and
pregnant pauses and nothing going on.
The awkward pauses and the physical comedy and audacious stuff and really just normal stuff. People had a copy machine and I loved it. And then I was, and here's another thing about failure, I was cast in this Janine Garofalo pilot that was going to be a series on ABC. She was really popular at the time.
She was hot at the time.
And then I was literally walking to the table read of it, and I ran into this TV executive, and they're like, we just got the rights to the American version of The Office, and we're going to start casting that soon and start shooting that. And I was like, oh, congratulations. And inside I was like, oh, I'm going to do this Janine Garofalo thing. And, we did the table read, and it's kind of legendary. It was one of the worst table reads of a script that's ever. They always do a table read of a script before all the executives.
And that's everybody that's
all the cast is there, and they read it out loud. And it was one of the worst ones that ever happened. And
why was it so bad?
You know, I think Janine didn't really want to do it.
Oh.
So she was not very on and charming. And it just didn't work. And the executives all got up and marched out. We had our plane tickets. They had the sets built. We were going to fly to Vancouver and start shooting in 2 days. And I was literally packing my suitcase. The phone rang. It's been pulled. You still get paid,
but
we're not going to shoot it.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes. And then that's when I got the audition for The Office. So you never know when these things, when these downturns actually turn into success.
Did you audition specifically for Dwight?
I auditioned at first for both Michael Scott and Dwight.
Okay.
And my Michael Scott was just a bad Ricky Gervais impersonation. Like, so anyway.
World's greatest boss.
World's greatest boss, yeah, right? Anyway, but I knew that the Dwight role or the Gareth role was really where I was going to, you know, make it. And I knew I had a good shot at it. And I was literally, in fact, there's a thing over here.
Check this out.
All right.
The casting director sent me, this is November 6th, 03, the sign-in sheet for the first day of auditions for The Office.
That's great. Sign in, please.
So all the actors that signed in, number one, Rainn Wilson. I was the first person to audition.
That's great.
For the TV show. Dwight and Michael. And on here, I think Jenna Fisher's on here as well. Jenna Fisher, who got Pam, is
right,
there.
Right, she's right there.
Some other great actors.
That's cool. You have it in a frame and everything like that.
Yeah, and the casting director found it in her files and sent it to me.
Oh,
so
that's great.
There it
that's
is.
That's it right there. Yeah. So when you guys first did The Office, I think the first episode was kind of based on, I remember the Jell-O, the stapler in the Jell-O, Dwight's staple was in the Jell-O, which is directly from Gareth's stapler being there. Mm-hmm. Was that the original idea, was to try and mimic it, or was that just the first one?
Well, what I found out is that Greg Daniels, who created The Office, is a total television genius, and he had done the show King of the Hill. He had written on Seinfeld, on The Simpsons. What he did, very cannily, is like, you know, TV networks are notorious meddlers. They'll get a really good piece of material and they'll nitpick it and cut that joke and make this character more likable and cut that scene and that's weird, make that go away. And all of a sudden they've got this watered down, terrible version of what was originally a really good project. And Greg knew this, so he's like, listen, the BBC version worked so well and the pilot of the BBC version worked so well. We should just do exactly what they did. And that was his argument. So they couldn't give notes.
Because it had already been
Because it had been proven to work. So he stuck very close to it. And then later we shot some additional materials for it. But that was the idea, to do a pilot very close to the British series. And then once we got into episodes, then to make it completely our own and break off. So
how is that when you have an ensemble cast, the greatest shows of all time? You're talking about Cheers. You're talking about, you know, Happy Days or Frasier. And I would put The Office in there. This great ensemble cast. How long does it take to get the chemistry with each other? Is it instant or does it take a while?
Well, it was another great thing that Greg Daniels did is we all read together multiple times. So we had a weekend of auditions and anyone being considered was there in the waiting room and they just mixed and matched people. So they read me with John Krasinski. They read me with like four or five other Jims. They read me with Jenna Fisher and lots of other Pams and with Steve Carell, but other people as Michael Scott and just And they taped it all. And then we improvised together and they would give us scenes and we'd try scenes. And so we got a sense, you know, he got a sense of who matched up really well. Mm-hmm. And so we were really, I mean, did we develop better chemistry through the episodes? Of course we did. But pretty early on, we had pretty damn good chemistry. And that was a great casting director, Allison Jones, great producer, Ben Silverman, and great director and writer. So, you know, all of those shows you named, like, to make a great TV show, you've got to have, it's all got to be good. You can't have a weak link. So it's got to have great writing, which The Office had. It's got to have great directors and the acting. So when it's successful, they really look at the actors. Like, oh, the actors are so good. But really, the success of The Office was like all of the people behind the scenes making it
happen. And that was like the rise of Steve Carell as well. He wasn't as big. Was he even...
When they cast him, he was doing a like fourth or fifth lead on a terrible NBC sitcom called Come to Papa. I'm not kidding. He played the crazy boss on Come to Papa. But at that time, he had just... shot Anchorman that was in the can, and then we shot the first season, and then Anchorman came out, and then 40-Year-Old Virgin came out right after that. So by the time we were in our second season, he was a full-blown movie star at that point. So he had come from Come to Papa to having his face all over America with the 40-Year-Old Virgin, remember?
Right, he was the lead of our show, looking on the billboards and
stuff. Even then, we almost got canceled, like, 10 different times.
So it wasn't a hit right off the start.
No, it wasn't. It was got pretty bad ratings, really bad reviews. And
is that because people were mostly trying to compare it to the English version?
Mostly did that, yeah. And it was just like less funny, too awkward. Like, people either didn't get it or compared us unfavorably to the British version. And it took a little while, you know. We were almost canceled like four or five different times, and we just hung on. They'd order like three more episodes here and two more episodes here and five more episodes here. And then it wasn't until really the end of our second season that the numbers just started to go and the ratings going up. And then we became a hit after that.
How was it playing Dwight, that character? You mentioned a lot of it was you, but it's just the biggest jerk, asshole character.
Yeah.
So weird.
Being a jerk and an asshole come pretty naturally to me, I have to say. So
I always loved his terrible hair with like, the part in the middle of his.
That's something I definitely stole from Mackenzie Crook.
Oh, okay.
I had read that he went and like got himself like the worst possible haircut. I thought that was like, that's brilliant. I'm going to do that exact same thing. So in my mirror, I designed Dwight's haircut. Like, what? I have a giant forehead. So let me just like highlight it as much as possible with the hair, like being little curtains, highlighting my enormous dome.
And kind of like really unflattering. Bald area, right?
Yeah,
the
yeah,
very
yeah.
top of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Which was amazing.
So, yeah.
Because people, I think people started to really,
we were one of the first shows where people were unattractive, you know, just very little makeup and bad lighting and just normal people. Phyllis, who's on the show, she was the assistant casting director.
Was she?
Yeah, and just like looks like from St. Louis, just a normal American.
Yeah.
Had done a little bit of acting, and she was just perfect. So that was also a little bit, I think, weird. We kind of broke the mold.
Because it's just an average, everyday office.
Yeah, exactly. Building. Yeah.
I love that Kevin was in a police tribute band called Scrantonicity.
Yeah.
That was my favorite line of the whole show, that he's in Scrantonicity.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite episodes of The Office?
Oh, man. They all blur at this,
Is there one that stands out for you as a good Dwight episode?
Yeah, I think there was one called Money. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the fourth season. It was a longer episode, and that's the first time they go out to Dwight's Beet Farm, to where he had a bed and breakfast. Yeah, and
was he like an Amish? Was he Amish or something?
Yeah, he had an Amish cousin.
Yeah,
and Amish fan, weird kind of Germanic Amish, weird relatives.
Yeah.
And so that was super funny. But they're all great. At some point, my son, when he gets old enough to appreciate him, will go back and I haven't watched him now. And you know,
did you ever watch your stuff? Did you watch?
I watched every week. I watched every episode. But I don't think I've seen an episodes more than once. I think I've seen them all once. Maybe a couple I've seen more than once. But so at some point, I want to go back and revisit it.
Is it hard to say goodbye to that character after 8 years of playing him? I believe it was 8 seasons, right?
No, we did the perfect run. We did 200 episodes, 8 or 9 seasons, and it was time to end. The creative well was running dry. Mm-hmm. But
Steve leaves.
Steve leaves. We had some different bosses come in. I truly believe like the last like 5 episodes of The Office of the final season are like 5 of the very best Office episodes we ever did. So we just went off on a high, and had a great finale. And what's interesting is our ratings were going down, but all ratings were going down across all TV shows. But now it's like the most popular show on Netflix. And there's a whole new legions of young people watching The Office, especially for some reason, high school students and college students love The Office. I have no idea why. They've never worked in an office. Mm-hmm. They don't know what it's like. They've never had a terrible boss or terrible workmates, but it has always appealed to high school and college kids.
Hmm. What's the rule for a syndication? You have to hit 100 episodes for syndication?
That used to be the rule, okay. But... you don't have to do that anymore.
Gotcha.
For syndication, yeah.
I didn't know, like, if you said 200 episodes, that means they're going to run forever.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't think we don't syndicate anymore. I think we're just only on Netflix.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Is there ever any talk about revisiting that character?
There's been some chatter about it online and stuff like that, but I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just too many... There's too many big stars. Like, I don't think Steve Carell would want to go back to it. Right. I don't think John Krasinski would want to come back to it. Ed Helms is busy doing tons of movies.
He was in it, too.
Yeah, wow. So I doubt that it would come together in that way, but it would be fun.
Just remember it and leave it at that.
Yeah.
Another thing that you mentioned that you've been doing is you were doing the new Star Trek show series. It's called Discovery?
Yep, Star Trek Discovery.
Now, that's a whole, like, you kind of, I'm going to assume this because we kind of have some similarities. Are you kind of a nerdy guy or Star Trek guy?
Totally nerdy guy. Love Star Trek growing up, the original series. Next Generation, I liked, and I definitely saw, let's say, a couple dozen episodes of it, but I was a little older then.
Yeah.
But yeah, total Star Trek nerd. And this character, Harry Mudd, that I'm doing in the new Star Trek, was a recurring character in the original
Mudd's
series.
Mudd's Women.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't he have a big mustache?
Yeah. Giant mustache. Yeah. And he was kind of over the top. He was kind of evil, kind of charming.
He was kind of an interplanetary pimp, wasn't he? What was his women
basically,
like?
Basically, yeah. Smuggler, merchant, ne'er-do-well.
Right.
And they wrote him really great for the new Star Trek series. So I got to do some episodes of that, and I'm really excited to see where that goes.
Is it like the Kirk cast, like the Kirk crew?
No, the Discovery is, I believe, like 20 years before Captain Kirk.
Gotcha.
During the Klingon Wars.
Okay. Anyways, it's pretty cool that you're doing that.
Yeah. It was a blast. I mean, to get to be like... on the bridge of a Federation ship and like use a phaser and get beamed somewhere and use an elevator, you know, all that stuff. It was amazing.
It's amazing to me that so much of the stuff that you saw in Star Trek in like the 60s, 67 or whatever, 66, is now happening today.
Yeah.
You know, like for example, like Kirk would look on the big screen and see a Klingon, like that's Skype.
Yep.
You know, you'd be in the ship calling down. I mean, you can call.
You were at your home in Tampa. They beamed you over here.
Completely, yeah. There's an app for that now.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Uh-huh. The teleportation app. Uh-huh. You know, but that's probably the only thing that they don't have. But it's amazing to me that all this stuff.
The communicators are like iPhones.
Yeah, sure, right.
Yeah. They even have scanners now that could do like the medical scanner things. They
all
have
of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it blows me away that they actually, like, I don't know if they predicted it or if it's just the way that the world works.
Roddenberry was a genius the way he created. And I also, here's the thing I really love about Star Trek is, you know, beyond all, we live in such a politically divided country. You know?
Right.
We've got these red states and these blue states, and people just don't get along, just chaos and disunity. And that vision of humanity having come together, you know, black and white and rich and poor to create the Federation and to go out into space and seek out new life and new civilizations and boldly go where no person has gone before. And, you know, that hope for humanity, that dream for humanity that we can all come together as not an American, not a red state or a blue state, just as human beings going out into the universe and meeting other races and, It's like the best of humanity,
leading
with the best of humanity.
Right.
And we need to get back to that, you know, as a people, as a species. Mm. We need to look to the vision, Roddenberry's vision of
from
the Federation.
Years ago,
of what humanity could do and could achieve, you know, working together. That's pretty inspiring.
Do you think that there's life on other planets?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's very egotistical to think that there wouldn't be.
Oh, it's crazy. We're one tiny little mud ball speck at an obsolete little galaxy of a trillion other galaxies out there. Really, we're the only ones.
We're the only ones.
Yeah.
Like, that's not Patterson.
I think aliens are watching us, seeing if we're going to blow ourselves up or not. They're like, it's up to them.
Yeah.
Prime directive, right?
Ah,
from Star Trek.
That's
we're
right.
not going to interfere.
Don't interfere.
We're just going to see if, like, the species is able to survive nuclear weapons, climate change, whatever, you know, political disunity, superpowers. If they can survive all this stuff then and get to the other side in a kind of a spiritual maturity, then maybe we'll reach out.
Yeah. I love it. At the end, I think it was Men in Black, where like it zooms out and it's just like aliens playing marbles with our planet. You know what I mean? It's like they're just collecting these planets and stuff. Yeah. You mentioned that you were in the rocker, and I mean, here I see a lot of rock and roll books on the wall and stuff. I mean, are you a big music fan?
I'm just a Fozzy fan, basically. So
you have to say that. The best thing is you go, man, I checked out your band. It's really good. And if I didn't like it, I wouldn't have even mentioned it. It's like, I checked out your band.
It's true. You hear about people being in bands, and then you look at their stuff and you're like, ooh, just not going to bring that in, you know, but your band rocks, man.
Oh, thanks, dude. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
So good. I grew up, you know, I grew up in suburban Seattle where we listened to both metal and punk. I think it was the only place, and that's why I believe grunge came out of Seattle, is that we grew up and it was okay to listen to AC/DC and Black Flag. Mm. And it was really like the only place where you could do that, because in the rest of the nation, it was you're one or the other.
You're right.
You know, one or the other. You had a shaved head or long hair, you know? And that's why the grunge kind of mixed the two, you know, in the musical styles. So
it's interesting because if you're looking at Guns N' Roses and Duff McKagan, obviously a Seattle guy, was a punk guy.
Yeah.
Then moves to L.A. and joins a metal band, switches to bass, but Guns N' Roses had that punk element.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that he directly came from Seattle with that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Appetite for Destruction is a great punk album.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a heavy punk album, but it's pretty punk.
Yeah.
It's the attitude of it, you know?
Yeah.
So Seattle, always a great music scene there.
Yeah, totally. But I left Seattle in 86, so I kind of missed that whole explosion. Mm-hmm. I went to New York City, so
we had heart.
I missed that. Yeah. Yeah, we had heart. Won't you, Barracuda?
So let's talk about some of the stuff that you do outside of your career. When you have some influence, like we mentioned earlier, Rain Wilson, which, by the way, I wish I had a cool name like Rain. Like, that's like a total, like...
Jericho's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, but that's showbiz.
You should be like Cher. Just cut it to Jericho.
Just Jericho.
Just Jericho.
Just Jerick.
Yeah.
Just Jericho.
Not Jerick. That guy. Oh,
just call me Jerick, baby.
That made me vomit in my mouth.
But that's like... Were your parents like kind of hippies? Or where'd you get the name Rain? That's pretty cool. I like it.
Yeah, I had pretty hippie bohemian parents living on a houseboat in Seattle in the late 60s.
No way. Living on a houseboat.
Yeah. So, That's just a made up name.
That's it.
Made up name.
Do you have any brothers or sisters with cool names?
No, just me.
Just you. So you were both only children.
Yeah.
Spoiled as shit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very selfish, spoiled tantrums.
Yeah.
So, but you're talking about the name of Rain Wilson, opening doors and stuff, and I know you do a lot of charity work, specifically in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
So explain to me how you got involved with Haiti and what made you feel a kindred spirit with them.
Well, one of the things that happened when I got to be a minor television celebrity is all of a sudden...
Were you about to burp there, or did you just say that you were a minor television celebrity?
You got me on that.
I did.
I had a little burp. I had a green apple before the interview, and it's like, it's not right.
But you've used a couple voices, so I didn't know if like minor television celebrity.
I kind of both. I combined the burp with the voice.
With the voice.
Yeah.
And but almost puked.
Being a minor television celebrity, if I puke, I promise to do it on camera.
Please, yeah,
so
get
you
it on
put
camera.
Put it on YouTube.
Puke on me.
Get what some views.
It'll go viral.
Click, bling, 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 bling. I started getting inundated with requests to be a part of a charity, join the board of a charity, raise money for a charity, be a spokesperson for a charity, all different kinds of charities, environmental things, political parties, physicians for social responsibility, you name it. And I was like, whoa, this is kind of crazy. I had done some charity work and arts work before, teaching at inner city schools and in arts programs. And but I hadn't really given much thought to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a deep dive into the world, the nonprofit world, and I take this stuff really seriously. And I read a lot of books and articles and really, like, where do I want to put my energy? Where do I want to put my effort? Where can I make the most impact? And how can I make the most impact? And that's when I discovered this foundation called the Mona Foundation. And they support educational initiatives around the world. Schools, grassroots schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did some fundraising for them, got to know them, learned more about education, arts education, girls education. And then we went down to Haiti. And that was right before the earthquake. And it was really eye-opening. I mean, just the poorest place that you've ever seen in your life.
Mm.
I mean, I'd traveled around some pretty poor places. I had backpacked through Guatemala and taken buses through Mexico. I'd been in Morocco. But this was like poverty on a whole other level. But at the same time, like the spirit of the country and the people, like the can-do attitude and their humor and their...
There's a butterfly joining us.
Kill it. See, I started talking about the Haitian people and a butterfly.
A butterfly comes in. Flute. That's a sign.
That was an Oprah moment.
It really was. Yeah. And we got it all on camera.
Yeah.
There's our viral moment.
Were we rolling?
And then we just got the part where you said, kill it.
Yeah.
It's just talking about how devastatingly poor.
Yeah, devastatingly poor. But I really fell in love with the country and the culture and... The Haitian people are so hardworking. They prize education and the arts so much. And it was really inspiring. And then 2 months later, the earthquake that killed 200,000 to 300,000 people in 2 minutes.
Mm.
I couldn't even imagine that kind of devastation. I mean, you hear about an earthquake killing 2,000 people, and it's unimaginable.
And how big is Haiti population-wise?
It's like 8 million people.
So you're talking about 200,000 to 300,000. That's like...
Yeah, it's maybe a big 4% chunk, percent of the population. Yeah, yeah. Not to mention all the wounded, all the homeless. So they moved the homeless people into these tent cities, and Sean Penn was running a charity that took over this one tent city. So we went there to do an arts program with girls. And I was really skeptical. It was a UN-funded program. I was really skeptical. I was like, well, these girls, they need houses and they need shoes.
You're talking about like girls, like teenage girls?
Teenage girls,
okay,
yeah.
So why specifically teenage girls?
Well, I'll get to that. Okay. But I was really skeptical of the program because I was like, they need shoes. Why are we teaching them poetry and photography and drama? But I went and did it, and it was just transformational to see these girls come alive with hope and just come alive. In new ways. Women are really mistreated in Haiti and a lot of developing countries. And this is why teenage girls, because there's very little hope for them. And this one girl at the end of our little session or art session, she came up and she was like, oh, I get what you guys do. Other people come and they give us jobs and they give us job skills and they give us clothing and they give us rice. You give us hope.
Hmm.
And that really clicked something off for my wife and I who are doing the workshops, and we're like, we need to do this more. We need to do arts-based, literacy-based education primarily for teenage girls in Haiti, outside of Port-au-Prince, the main city, out in the rural areas, the farm girls, the ones who really get ignored, try and get them into school, give them scholarships, and that's how we created the program LIDE Haiti, and that was the origin. That was the origin of it.
When you went down originally, did you go with Sean Penn?
I met Sean a couple of times down there and got a tour of what he was doing. He did amazing work down there. I mean, he's a real polarizing figure in a lot of ways. But I'm telling you, the work he did in Haiti, man, he saved thousands of lives. Mm. He's built tens of thousands of housing units. He's built medical clinics. He's single-handedly fundraised millions and millions of dollars that he's poured into the economy of Haiti. And not handouts either, like schools, job opportunities. It's done amazing work.
I really like what you were saying about the work that you're doing too, though, because you're talking about, like I said, it's very easy to just drop off a pair of shoes and go, there you go, on your way.
Yeah.
But spending the time and actually not just hope, but like there's something as a creative person, being creative, it does bring you to life.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
And you know, like you said, arts and acting and all that sort of thing. I can see that really giving, I think, hope, but also, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for, energy, life.
Yeah, purpose.
Life force,
yeah.
Purpose,
yeah.
You know?
And it creates community,
mm-hmm.
too. You know, girls in Haiti are put to work when they're 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
They're in charge of the babysitting, cooking, working in the fields, selling in the markets. They're just worked to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
While the dudes kick soccer balls around and try and get jobs as taxi drivers, you know?
Mm.
So it's a really, it's an education, it's a population that needs attention and empowerment. And you don't empower by giving someone a bag of rice.
Mm.
You don't empower by giving them shoes. You empower them by giving them education, teaching them to read, teaching them to believe in themselves, to find their own voice, to move forward. So that's what LIDE is all about.
So when you go down there, do you ever, like, do people embrace you? Is there any, like, danger? Is it, like, did you ever see people want, like, this guy was going to rob me or he's going to mug me or something along those lines?
Haiti is a very safe place if you're an American.
Really?
Not so safe if you're a wealthy Haitian. Because anytime, like, a Westerner or an American is robbed or kidnapped or something like that, like, the government goes apeshit, you know, and the army comes out and it's like all this attention comes.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They kind of learned, like, okay, if we're going to rob people, we're going to rob wealthy Haitians that either come back or rise up in the Haitian society. So any wealthy Haitians you see will always have bodyguards and stuff like that, but it's really safe.
For you, it's cool.
Yeah, it's safe. But I've seen some really horrible, horrible stuff. I mean, we had a woman try and give us her baby. You know, it was, it had birth defects. She was pregnant again, too poor to take care of, had a couple of other kids, and was just trying to give away this baby. Not because she didn't love it, but she just didn't have the ability to take care of it.
It has no future, yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen some really dark stuff there. You know, there's tons of sexual abuse, tons of sexual slavery.
Human trafficking.
Human trafficking. Young, there's a lot of charities around human trafficking, right? But the best way to solve human sex trafficking is to educate the girls. Because when they're educated, they won't say, okay, I'll go to the Dominican Republic and work in a bar for a job. They have a belief in themselves in staying home and getting an education, and they're not as naive, they're not as gullible, and they're not going to head in that direction.
Mm-hmm. What's your overall plan for LIDE? Is this something, are you constantly going to Haiti to do this, or is it something that you kind of started the program and leave it in the hands of some Haitian actors, or
both? We go down about 3 or 4 times a year. We do training with the teachers and the facilitators in drama and creative writing.
So there's teachers actually down there that keep this rolling.
Oh yeah, we have a Haitian staff of 30 or 40.
Oh wow.
We're working with almost 600 girls in like 12 or 13 locations, and it's all entirely Haitian run at this point. We have a great staff, and my job really is to raise the money here in the United States. And now that we're kind of up and running, we've been running for 3 or 4 years now, and then we're going to slowly continue to expand.
Mm-hmm.
And we're reaching 600 girls, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another million or girls that need this same kind of work. So trying to figure out how to grow. I'd like to ultimately create some kind of digital media company for the young girls, like a YouTube channel or something like that, where they can make, Haitian girls can make empowering videos for other Haitian girls, inspire them and reach much larger numbers. But we're going to need some serious funding to do something like that. That could be another branch of what we do. But we've put dozens of girls into school, lots of scholarships, and we've taught hundreds how to read.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we feed the girls, because for many of them, the only meal they get during the day is the meal they get at our organization. The poverty down there is pretty shocking. One time we asked the girls how many of them have ever had breakfast. About half the girls had breakfast, which means half the girls in our program had never in their lives eaten breakfast. That kind of puts it in perspective.
Never got up and had something to eat, basically.
No, just a glass of water in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's perspective there, right?
And the girls are always the last to eat. So they cook for the whole family. The whole family, if there's something left, the girls get to eat it. So
Wow. So just a final couple of last questions. I was going to ask this before when you talk about Star Trek, and I had William Shatner on my show, and to be there with, you know, oh my gosh, it's William Shatner, it's Captain Kirk. I had Henry Winkler on when I was a kid. I was a huge Fonz fanatic, Paul sure. Stanley.
You kind of got the Fonz hair a little bit.
It's growing out a bit. That's why yeah. it's in that weird stage right now. Is there anybody that you ever worked with over your career that you're like, you couldn't believe that you got a chance to work with this actor? Or
There've been so many actors that I've gotten to work with mm-hmm. that I was just stunned. But I just, the first story that comes to mind is I loved Monty Python when I was growing up.
Yeah, me too.
I loved British comedy. Yeah. And I just started doing 6 Feet Under, and I went to an HBO premiere of some movie in Hollywood, and Eric Idle from Monty Python was like right up in front of me. And I said to my wife, I was like, oh my God, it's Eric Idle. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
And he's like, because I just worshiped those movies. I saw Life of Brian and the Holy Grail like so many times. And then we were walking out, and 6 Feet Under had just started playing. And I was like, should I talk to him? What should I say, guy? What do you think? And she was like, I don't know. And don't bother him, you know. And then he turned around and he saw me and he came over and he was like, oh, hello. You're wonderful on the 6 Feet Under. Hello. So nice to meet you. My name's Eric. And I was just, oh.
No shit, buddy.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. I got to be a host at VH1 Music Awards, mm-hmm. and I got to interview Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey.
Oh, dude, that's
and
great.
It was like, I loved The Who so much growing up. And,
yeah.
You know, you just, there's some perks. There's some mm-hmm. big perks to doing what I'm doing. Like mm-hmm. You get to meet your heroes.
There's something else I was going to ask you about, too. I saw on the wall over that, I actually forgotten that you hosted Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's an elite club.
That's huge, a pinnacle.
Huge bucket list thing for me.
Yeah.
Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, you know, fortunately, The Office was an NBC show, so they haul out some of the TV actors from NBC to put them on to promote the show on Saturday Night Live. I think they leave a slot or two per season, and mm-hmm. I was getting some attention as Dwight early on. It was 2007, 2008, thereabouts, and got the call, and it was amazing, you know? I mean, it was just a dream come true. I was 11, 12 years old when Saturday Night Live started in the late 70s and would stay up till 1 in the morning watching every single one mm-hmm. with my friend and, you know, getting to, you know, it's Saturday Night Live. Yeah, it's Rainn Wilson. And coming down the steps to the audience. And
was
stuff
Don was, Pardo still alive?
Yeah, yeah. It was insane. It was absolutely nuts.
Is it funny, Lorne Michaels, like when you meet him, how much like you realize, oh my gosh, he's Dr. Evil.
Yeah, yeah, it's
like
true.
It's
that's
totally
true. He's very Machiavellian, yes. And he's got it all in his head,
hello,
all under
Rain.
Control.
How are you? You're very funny.
So how does it work though? You show up on a Monday. Are you there all week?
Yeah, they're all week rehearsing Monday.
Are you writing as well?
You meet the writers. Mm. They're pitching their ideas of what they want to write. They stay up all night, like Tuesday and Wednesday. By Wednesday, you're reading some sketches, rehearsing some on Thursday, and Saturday running them. Running them by that point, a bunch get cut mm-hmm. right up to the moment. Like the dress run is like 2 hours and 20 long, and then they cut a whole bunch of sketches, which sucks because you have to, you know, kind of kill your babies, and then it's like getting shot out of a cannon. But I just went with it. I got some good tips from actors that had done it before because you're reading them off cue cards and stuff like that.
It's very meticulous that way, right?
Yeah.
You have to read off the cards.
You'll never go up. You'll never like forget what you're doing because, mm-hmm. And someone gave me a great tip. They were like, don't look at the actor's eyes and at the cue cards, because you'll be doing this right. the whole time, right?
Yeah, eyes will
just
back and forth.
Look at the cue card, and the camera will make it seem like you're looking at the guy, the camera angle, but just look at the cue card and just read it. So I just did that, and several people were like, I can't believe that you memorized your lines. Such a good job, you know. But the cast was super nice and great, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, and that, like you said, like you have the picture on the wall of the classic, like the Andy Warhol type pictures where it's all, you know, the different colors and stuff. That's great. Very cool. Yeah. Last two questions. Number one, what's your favorite band of all time?
Radiohead.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. I saw you have a Wilco poster over there.
Love Wilco. Yeah. Close number two, but I love Radiohead.
Have you ever had a chance to meet those guys?
I actually, the last time they were in the States, the at Santa Barbara Bowl was sold out, but we got some tickets to Berkeley. Took my son, who's a big Radiohead fan too. He's 12 years old. We flew up there and somehow got a backstage pass, and Tom York didn't come out. And Johnny Greenwood didn't come out, but we met the drummer, Phil Selway, who's a great drummer.
You got the drummer, yeah.
Unappreciated drummer. Yeah, but yeah. I played a drummer.
That's right, you're the rocker.
In fact, I got the wig for the rocker right here.
Right here. It's almost like a longer...
It's sitting here. I got the drum kit for the rocker in my basement.
Is that
so
the
check
exact
this out.
Wig? Like it's, oh my gosh, wig. It's like the rocker. He's back.
It's like nine years old, this wig.
It's almost like a longer Dwight Schrute haircut, just like...
Yeah. So...
I like how we've been going through the souvenirs as the show's been going on. That's great. And last question, what's your favorite role that you've played?
Favorite role that I've played, I have to say the movie Super that James Gunn did, where I was a vigilante superhero. You dig that movie.
I have to check it out. Yeah.
I bash bad guys in the face with a pipe wrench.
Nice.
And then my sidekick is Ellen Page. And total lunatic, but it's really funny, but heartbreaking at the same time, and kind of cartoony. It's a strange melange of tones. It's like nothing you've ever seen.
Yeah. Did that just come and go? Was it kind of an art?
It did terrible. It was one of those movies that no one saw it when it came out. Yeah. No one saw it at all. And now people have been seeing it. It's on Netflix and people see it. And James Gunn has, because of Guardians of the Galaxy, and he's become big, they check it out and really enjoy it. So I got a lot of super fans out there. So that's been great.
Dude, you can go to comic conventions till the end of time.
I know. And now that I'm on Star Trek,
you're right? set.
How much do you make for signing those?
Oh, dude, you can make $50 a shot.
$50 a headshot?
Yeah.
Do you ever do that?
Well, a few here and there.
Yeah.
But I do them only if someone that I can meet, like Henry Winkler. They said, "Do you want to do it? Who else is on it?" I go through. Oh, Henry Winkler's there. I'll do it if you can get me an interview with Henry Winkler. Okay.
Oh, so you hook it up with a podcast?
Yeah.
Nice.
That's how I DMC. DMC. So that's the way to do it.
I would do that for charity. I would do it.
Then, with Dwight and now with Star Trek and all this other stuff that you have. Yeah. And Fishboy.
Fishboy.
That I'd buy a Fishboy.
Come on.
They need to make a Fishboy doll. Action figure.
I know.
Fishboy action figure.
I know.
There we go. Rob, make it happen.
Yeah.
And Fishboy has to be riding a Zonky.
That's perfect. That's your motion
Zonky
picture,
boy.
Directing debut.
I want to be Zonky Boy.
Zonky Boy.
There you go.
You'll always be my Zonky Boy.
Thank you, dude.
Okay, Jericho.
All right.
And now, Reflections with Raven.
The aliens they have at Roswell said... The only reason they didn't attack Earth is because it's too tiny. I guess it is a small world after all.
For more Reflections with Raven, listen to The Raven Effect on the Jericho Network via the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts.
There's so many moments like that in every single episode of The Raven Effect. Trust me, this week they talk about blading, about how Raven doesn't like Vince McMahon. They talk about a very hilarious poop story. They talk about if you can get pregnant from a dead man. Lots of ridiculous stuff on The Raven Effect. Check that out every week. Go ahead and subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Leave Raven and Busby a 5-star rating and review while you're there. Do it for all the shows at the Jericho Network. Let us entertain you all week long, starting with the Team Talk Tiger Awesome Show on Sunday mornings. Great rock talk with Mitch LaFon on Mondays. This week, talking with Mike Tramp of White Lion, who just buries Vito Bratta, his old guitar player. So if you're into 80s metal like White Lion, go check out Mitch LaFon this week. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus on Tuesdays. Always love talking to them. As a matter of fact, Cyrus and Mark Madden will be here next week talking about the life and times of Bobby the Brain Heenan. And of course, the flagship show, Keep It 100 with Conan, every Thursday. A little bit of a shakeup over there. KG is gone. JoJo the Twink Boy is there. But Shane Helms is taking over. And still lots of great stuff from the Mass Republic Minute, the Hoovy Juice, Triple A. So much good stuff. So, of course, Beyond the Darkness, new episodes every weekday, scaring the crap out of you 5 days a week. Beyond the Darkness. Thanks to all of them. And thanks to Rain Wilson, such a great guy. Thanks for the head up on the Zonky and all the great charity work he's doing. You learn something new every day. And, of course, thanks to all all of you, the great people who are listening, and all the great sponsors of Talk is Jericho, and to all of you for supporting these sexy beasts like FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com. Use my promo code Jericho to try FanDuel for free with no deposit. Of course, TrueCar as well. Go to FozzyRock.com and pick up some tickets to the tour, to the gigs that are near you. It's starting very, very soon. And of course, ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Go check it out. Look at the information for the greatest destination vacation of your lifetime in October of 2017. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And coming up next Wednesday, like I said, Don Callis and Mark Madden, two tremendous color commentators. Don, of course, from ECW, currently of New Japan. And Mark Madden was a WCW commentator for about 8 years. They talk about the great Bobby the Brain Heenan, the influence, the life, the times, and was Bobby the greatest all-around performer in wrestling history? We're going to find out. So Wednesday, Bobby Heenan remembered. Until then, in the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!